you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Sean Atwood on the show. Sean is a speaker, author, activist based in London, who was banned from travel to the United States. He was an inmate in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail. He blogged there, created a journal, John's Jail Journal. I think they did surreptitiously with a pencil he sharpened against the wall. Is that correct?
It was easier to sharpen it on the steel door actually than the wall. It took longer on the wall.
Okay. So you have a very interesting story there. Among his several books are Pablo Escobar, Beyond Narcos, and American Made: Who Killed Barry Seal? Pablo Escobar or George H.W. Bush, and of course, Hard Time, a harrowing yet often darkly humorous account of his time when Sean was incarcerated. He spent, you navigated the world of gang violence, insect and rat-infested food, and just the whole jail experience, and he shared his experience in that book. Sean's website is seanatwood.com. Sean, is that anything else you want to add to that intro? Did I miss anything? Or?
Yeah, that all sounds great. Thank you.
Okay, and you're working on the third book of that trilogy, I think, of the Drug War trilogy?
I've got a War on Drugs series now.
Okay.
And the fourth book has actually jumped ahead of the third because Narcos Season 3 is about the Cali cartel.
Uh-huh.
So I've got my fourth book in the series is coming out, The Cali Cartel Beyond Narcos, in August. So I put the third book on hold, which will come out after that. The third book is We Are Being Lied To, The War on Drugs.
Okay, so those two aren't out yet. They're in production.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, well, tonight I want to talk to you about, the war on drugs, the prison industrial complex, and Barry Seal. Of course, that opens the whole can of worms, because that opens up it introduces to the world of intelligence and the netherworld of intelligence, how it connects to the underworld of the international drug trade. But you have a personal experience in this, so maybe the best way to introduce this topic is to tell us your story and how you got involved in researching the drug war and all that it entails.
Okay, so I was raised in a little town in the northwest of England. It was a chemical manufacturing town called Widnes. So I didn't have much money growing up. I aspired to make money in the stock market from a young age, started following it at 14, started trading it at 16. As a teenager, I'd visited my aunts and uncles in Phoenix, Arizona, and I saw how luxurious it was out there compared to my little town, where it was constantly raining. Get off the plane in Arizona, you know, the sun, the heat, the swimming pools, the cars, the roads, the houses, everything seemed twice the size to me. And whenever anyone heard my accent, they would roll out the red carpet. So I'm thinking, you know, I want to move out here after I finish all my education. I did a business studies degree, came out to Phoenix, and got a job as a stockbroker. Bit of a Wolf on Wall Street environment. I wasn't much good at it at first, but 5 years in, I was the top guy in the office, grossing $500,000 a year. And I had enough money to retire. I invested that into technology shares during the dot-com bubble, and I ended up worth a couple of million. Now, unfortunately, I was in my 20s, and I was emotionally immature. I couldn't handle having that much money at an early age. It went to my head. It went to my ego. And I started to throw rave parties for up to 10,000 people at a time. And I was importing ecstasy. In the beginning, it started out with me hooking my friends, but it escalated. And I saw the business potential of it, and I got greedy. And on May 16th, 2002, I had to answer my karma when a SWAT team smashed my door down. I ended up in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail, where not only were the gang members murdering the prisoners, even the guards were murdering mentally ill prisoners. You know, occasionally there was a dead rat in the food, there was cockroaches crawling all over at night. It was completely drug and gang infested. And if you're a white person, you come under the control of the neo-Nazi Aryan Brotherhood prison gang. But I saw the horror of what drug use led to in the prison. 90% of the guys shooting up heroin, crystal meth, two-thirds hepatitis C, yellow jaundice, skin, teeth rotting out. It made me ashamed of putting people on that road of drug use. And I pledged never to do drugs again. But not only that, to go out and share my story with young people in the hope they wouldn't make my mistakes. So that's led to me now becoming an author and a public speaker. And I do over 100 talks a year in schools in the UK. I'm banned from America, so I can't come and do any talks over there. But I also, after writing my life story as a trilogy, I was looking for something, a natural progression, and that became the war on drugs. For the past 5 years, I've been researching the war on drugs intensively, and that's what led to me writing this series of War on Drugs book. Not only that, I met people in the prison system who were involved at the high ends with the Mexican cartel, involved with the, you know, with the feds. And the stories they told me blew my mind. I didn't believe a lot of it at the time about the CIA being the biggest mafia and the DEA, you know, doing all these things in Mexico, illegal things. And but getting out and researching it, I think Barry Seal's story is just the ultimate example of that.
Yeah, the story of Barry Seal is very interesting because it reveals so much about the world of intelligence, the deep state, the intrigues of the cryptocracy, and how it connects to the underworld, the criminal world. And that goes way back to the history of the intelligence community because as far back, well, here in the United States, the OSS formed an alliance with the organized crime like Lucky Luciano during the Second World War and also the early stages of the Cold War, first to fight fascism and then communism in Italy. And that set up this arrangement, although those arrangements probably go back prior even to the Second World War. Of course, in your home country, you have MI6. And MI6 largely developed out of the banking financial interests that grew out of the opium trade with the British East India Company. So it's got long roots, deep roots.
If you go back that far, you could say that Queen Victoria was the biggest drug dealer in the world at one point.
Yeah, I remember a while back I was Lynn LaRouche. If you know, you're familiar with him. Well, he's an American. He's one of these considered kind of a nutcase, but he's kind of a marginal, you know, political. He's run for president. He's a LaRoucheite. He's been heavily marginalized, and I don't necessarily agree with everything the LaRoucheites have to say. But he years ago, he used to say that the Queen of England is the biggest drug dealer in the world. And at the time, I thought he was nuts. What? Then I started doing the history of the drug trade, and the British Empire was the biggest most successful narco state in the history of the world, and I realized that what he said was exactly correct. It was, you know. But he's made fun of a lot because he said something like that. Obviously you've had with the vast financial interest that developed out of the opium trade. Of course, there are two opium wars fought in the 19th century to secure control of the drug trade, particularly in China, by the British. But then, of course, the Americans got into the action with the Russells and the Russell Trust, and they formed Skull and Bones. Yale University, the name Yale was, I think, named after a guy, a wealthy man who worked for the British East India Company, which is, of course, much of their profits are derived from the opium trade. So it's part of the establishment. It's just one of these, it's the dirty unsecret. If you just do a little research, realize just how important the drug trade is to international finance and the world power structure. And Barry Seal is one of those characters that if you study his background, it opens up, you know, you can get a glimpse into how the world operates. But you've written a book about Barry Seal. And what does Barry Seal, his life and his times and what he did, what did that tell us about the drug war and about, about the world of intelligence and the whole financial system?
Well, the conclusion I reached is that the U.S. government, the federal government, on one hand, is purporting to fight the war on drugs, locking up millions of people who are drug users, predominantly marijuana arrests, predominantly people from poor economic backgrounds, black people, Mexican people, and profiting from it via these private prisons and all kinds of corporate entanglements. Yet, on the other hand, through the CIA, they're actually smuggling the drugs in. So you got these people who are using drugs that might have very well have been brought in by your own government, ending up in prison under the laws of the same government. And people like George H.W. Bush, who are, I would say, at the top of this pyramid when Barry Seal was operating, you know, they control both sides of the chessboard so they can maximize their profits. And at the end of the day, it's the people who suffer.
Mm-hmm. You said George Bush was probably the biggest drug kingpin of the 1980s, and he was the vice president of the United States.
I would say that George H.W. Bush was the most successful drug pin of the 1980s, not Pablo Escobar, because he got away with it. He had the full force and backing of the U.S. military. The CIA were bringing these, you know, massive shipments of cocaine in on military planes, and that's what Barry Seal did. He was flying these planes for the CIA, bringing billions and billions of dollars worth of cocaine, predominantly into a little town called Mena, Arkansas. But my research has led me to believe that this was going on all over the country, especially, you know, places like Marana Air Base in Arizona, Texas seems to be quite big for it as well. Anywhere there's military bases, they were bringing stuff in.
Yeah, there was an interesting case I read where a little old lady, a widow, found out that she owned some land, I think, out in the southwest somewhere, Arizona, New Mexico. And she found out that someone did a survey, an aerial survey, and someone had built a runway on her property that could receive C-130s.
Wow, doesn't surprise me in the least.
She's like, that's not my runway. Yeah, and, you know, it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, if you ever walk around, you know, if you're out in the woods somewhere, you come across someone's marijuana crop or something, or a drop site. And, of course, there's a real death toll because with Barry Seal, you had the case of the two boys on the tracks in Arkansas.
Yeah, on August 22nd, 1987, 17-year-old Kevin Ives went to spend the night at the house of his friend, 16-year-old Don Henry. And these were just two fresh-faced, you know, teenagers. And the next day at 10 a.m., Kevin's mum, Linda Ives, got a call. And it was Don's dad asking, you know, were the boys? And she said she thought they were with him. Unfortunately, their bodies were found on railroad tracks and dead, and the coroner ruled that they had got stoned on marijuana, they'd got in a trance, fallen asleep on the railway tracks, and died side by side. But as you correctly pointed out earlier, people were, you know, coming across these drug drops, and it's obvious that that's what happened to Kevin Ives and Don Henry. And bear in mind, that was Barry Seal died in 1986, February 19th, 1986. So for this to happen in August 22nd, 1987, it shows that the CIA program was continuing, and that they tried to make it out that Barry Seal was a renegade who was just running this mission on his own. Well, how the hell is it still going on after he's dead? Mm-hmm. Not only that, the DEA, he only flew one load for the DEA, the load that Ronald Reagan used to say that the Nicaraguan government was dealing cocaine, when really it was the rebels with the help of the CIA. What about all the other loads that he brought in? So his you know, the mainstream viewpoint of Barry Seal is he was a renegade guy who was dealing drugs, got busted by the DEA and became an undercover DEA agent. And that's what the movie's going to represent, I reckon, when it comes out in September. The Dennis Hopper movie sure did. So they're all constantly leaving out this involvement with the CIA, which is the biggest part of his story.
Yeah, because that was his protection. Because his entire background, because he has connections to the agency dating back to when he was a teenager in the 1950s, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Barry's history, as a kid, he got obsessed with planes. He'd take his bike over to the airport, watch the comings and goings. By 15, he was actually flying, making money from towing advertising banners. And all the money from his paper round went towards flying lessons. So as he got older, you know, he was already known for having these skills, because when his football team played out of state, he would fly out there, land in a helicopter. He was taking young women on dates, on flights. So this came to the attention. He joined the Baton Rouge Civil Air Patrol, and that's where he met Lee Harvey Oswald, who was from another unit. Barry was with the New Orleans unit. And that's also where he met David Ferry. If anyone's watched JFK, that's the Joe Pesci character in JFK.
And David Ferry is... he deserves a book for his life, because he used a strange character. He was involved in medical experiments in New Orleans with mice, and this involves, some people believe, weaponized virus or weaponized cancer. That's in Dr. Mary's Monkey. But he connects. He's also another pilot who got in trouble for morals charges. Because he was also a pedophile, from what I understand, or at least interested in teenage boys, rather.
Well, he was formerly a priest.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He was interested in teenage boys, and he got defrocked. Teaching aeronautics at Cleveland's Benedictine High School, he was fired for several infractions, including taking boys to a house of prostitution. And yeah, like you said, he. He lost his job at Eastern Airlines because of the morals charges that came about.
And now he was also a witness for Garrison. He was the primary target of Garrison till he suddenly died in 1967. That's when Garrison switched to Clay Shaw, if I recall. If I got that detail correct. And another thing is also Barry Seal has connection to Clay Shaw, because Barry Seal, I believe, had an office at the Trademark International Trade that was run by Clay Shaw.
Right, I wasn't aware of that, actually.
Yeah, so his connections, possible connections to the Kennedy assassination.
Well, his wife said that, Barry's wife said that he flew one of the getaway planes for the Kennedy assassination.
Out of Dallas, yeah. And
yeah.
He would have been, I guess, 23 years old at that time, 23, 24 at the time. And there's also this in Daniel Hopsicker's book, Barry and the Boys, the cover of it, features these guys down in Mexico, I think, in like January or February 1963. And I think it has included in the photo is Barry Seal, along with Felix Rodriguez, I think, who's covering his face, if I recall. And there's also one, what appears to be a very young Porter Goss, a future congressman and director of Central Intelligence, in the photograph.
Yeah, and those relationships continued for a long time. And, you know, I've got George H.W. Bush pegged as the guy who gave the nod to have Barry assassinated by giving up his address and taking away his protection. But the two underlings were Felix Rodriguez and Oliver North, who were instrumental in that.
That's right. And now, that's an interesting story, because at the time, Barry was at a halfway house because he'd gotten in trouble, was that the Quaalude conviction he was dealing with? And he also had a problem with the IRS. And I believe he'd gotten that halfway house sentencing. And because of the IRS harassment, he had called and threatened George H.W. Bush, if I got that detail correct.
Yeah, what happened was that Barry, to help the CIA with this mission of bringing all these drugs in, Barry agreed to pretend to be a drug smuggler that got busted by the DEA. So to do that, he actually did have to go through the motions of all this stuff and get busted by the DEA and agree to work for the DEA, which were that one load came in that, you know, he helped that Bush and Reagan, where they took the photos with Pablo Escobar. But at the end of the day, Barry knew so much that when it came time for him to kind of untangle from that role, and he turned to his superiors, such as Bush, to help him out, because he had so much pressure on him at that point in time, you know, in the federal court system, Bush just let him go. He didn't want all that information to come out. So Barry saw the writing was on the wall, and he called Bush, you know, around just before he got assassinated, and threatened to blow the lid on the whole of the CIA operation in MENA. But Oliver North apparently was guiding these Colombians to exactly where Barry was located, and he got assassinated.
The Colombians had Ollie North's code name, correct?
Yeah. The lawyer for the Colombians said publicly that they were getting guided by Oliver North, but of course all that was left out of the of the public records at the trials of the Colombians. In fact, some of the Colombians were allowed just to go home.
But yeah, it was like an 8-man team, or like it was a death squad. It wasn't just it was like eight men, from what I understand. And yeah, most of them were allowed to go back. And his name was John Caffey. Oliver North was known as John Caffey. And of course, with Barry Seal, an interesting story is that on his body, was George H.W. Bush's direct line phone number, correct?
Yeah, and he called George H.W. Bush in the presence of his lawyer.
That's a great story. Unglesby, I think, is the lawyer's name. Lawyer was didn't understand the full picture, and then does he throw a phone across the table and he says, call this number.
Yep, and then when he identified himself as his lawyer, they hung up on him.
And so, but why he was gunned down like this, it wasn't just George H.W. Bush out to get Barry Seal. It seemed like there was sort of like a purge going on, like a cleansing, because this seemed to coincide with the time when the U.S. government, the CIA, was switching its alliance from Medellin to the Cali cartel. So that's an interesting detail, right, in this intrigue?
Yeah. When people hear that you know, that the CIA was bringing all these drugs in the 1980s, a lot of people have a hard time believing it, but they've got to understand the context, geopolitics back then. The priority in South America was fighting communism, and the drug market had got so big that the U.S. government was afraid if that fell into the hands of the communists, they'd be able to get more weapons, and next thing, you know, all of these countries in South America would topple, and communism would be knocking on America's back door. So the CIA worked with drug organizations that were anti-communist, anti-guerrilla, right-wing, If you go back to 1980 and look at the cocaine coup in Bolivia, the Argentine intelligence services, with the CIA and with the neo-Nazi Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, who was responsible for over 10,000 murders, they overthrew the Bolivian government and put cocaine dealers in charge because they were right-wing and they were assassinating communists and anyone that was left-wing, human rights activists, labor leaders, union leaders, priests, you name it. And it was that proliferation of cocaine then from these, you know, the source countries, Bolivia, Peru, it flows up to Colombia, that helped, you know, it provided the opportunities for Pablo Escobar. Now, in the very beginning, Pablo Escobar, he said that he was working with the CIA and that George Bush, he had an agreement with him. But George Bush, who wasn't popular politically, had decided to get tough. And he'd, reversed on this agreement with Pablo and the Medellin cartel. And if you look at actually people like federal government witnesses like Carlos Leda, who was a senior member of the Medellin cartel out of the four main factions, he said that he contributed up to $10 million drug money to Felix Rodriguez for the war in Nicaragua. And Millian Rodriguez, a money manager for the Medellin cartel, also under oath, said exactly the same thing. So it seems that there was a turning point where George H.W. Bush, he was more concerned about boosting his ratings, and from Nixon they knew, you know, the war on drugs was a good one for the voters, so they needed a bogeyman and they made Pablo Escobar the scapegoat.
Hello,
yeah,
sorry,
can you hear me?
You cut out that scapegoat. I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah. So Pablo was made a scapegoat by George H.W. Bush. And this has recently been confirmed, the fact that Pablo was working with the CIA, by Pablo's own son. A couple of months ago, he said he's got a new book out now, and in it he's detailing his father's relationship with the CIA, and that he was giving the CIA a great price on cocaine, and the war on drugs is not what the American public thinks that it is.
And a similar story with Manuel Noriega of Panama, correct?
Well, if you look at Panama, that was where all of the drug money was getting laundered. But not only that, all the money for the CIA was getting laundered as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Chip Tatum who said that some of Pablo's billions in Panama ended up in the hands of George H.W. Bush.
Well,
it was the case of a much bigger gangster taking out a littler gangster.
Yes, and now they got in league with the Cali cartel, and they've since moved on, because there's now talk of, because that was in a federal district court in Chicago, with this trial, with this informant saying that the U.S. government is now working with the Sinaloa cartel for various intelligence, operations and projects.
Yeah, it's ongoing. Going back to the Cali cartel briefly, after they took Pablo down, they needed a new bogeyman for the war on drugs. So they went after the Cali cartel, but this was highly selective because the other faction of the Medellin cartel was the Castaño brothers. I don't know if you've watched Narcos, but the Castaño brothers, Fidel and Carlos, they went on to form the Death Squad Los Pepes, which was backed by the CIA and backed by the Cali cartel, which hunted down Pablo Escobar and ultimately was responsible for his demise, I believe, was Los Pepes. So after Pablo was killed, the Cali cartel became the bogeyman in the war on drugs. But the Castaños were allowed to continue. They took over a lot of Pablo's cocaine infrastructure. But because they were formed the AUC and they were fighting the FARC guerrillas, and they were even assassinating union leaders and human rights activists for corporations, you know, got to keep those incomes down for the poorest people in Colombia, they were given a pass by the CIA. Not only that, they were one of the Castaño brothers was rewarded with a trip to Disneyland. So while the authorities were hunting down the Cali cartel, one of the Castaños was out there enjoying Disneyland.
The Magic Kingdom, huh? Well, that's an interesting insight, because it is true that drugs are not only an incredible source of profits for a source of funding for black ops, off the book operations. It also provides an enormous amount of liquidity for the banking system. It pumps up Wall Street, but it also uses a weapon to destabilize certain regions, certain countries. Like in South America, you can keep a country poor, undeveloped. You can go in there and exploit the resources, be it human labor or, you know, just raw materials, because they won't develop locally. And it's a source of cheap labor, which can then be used for any number of reasons, because as you see now with weaponized migration, you can use it to destabilize a country if you'd like. You know, like what's happened with Syria, where certain NGOs are bringing in migrants, supposedly refugees from war, into European countries, and no one's asking why those countries are at war in the first place. Why are they being destabilized? They're being destabilized by NATO and the Western countries. And the same thing has occurred for decades, for the better part of a century, in Latin America, by the United States, to keep those countries poor, destabilize, prevent, you know, land reform. And of course, we've had, you know, 1954 in Guatemala, when the CIA took out Arbenz's government for the benefit of United Fruit Company, and of course what happened in Chile in 73, and you also have, of course, not in Latin America, but in Iran in 1953, when they took out Mossadegh for the benefit of the Western, you know, Anglo-American oil companies. So it's just what they do, you
know. And that's exactly why Pablo Escobar was a hero to the poor, because U.S. foreign policy was to keep the status quo. You had an extreme inequality of wealth. You had all these people getting the land stolen from them by corporations and by Colombian elites. Mm-hmm. And they'd end up living at these garbage dumps. And Pablo went to the garbage dumps, and he built houses for them and hospitals and schools. And I'm not saying Pablo was a good guy, but, you know, he's a psychopath responsible for 3,000 to 4,000 deaths. But through the eyes of the poor, he was a hero because he did all these things that the government didn't do for him.
Yes, he sounded like a populist politician. In many
exactly,
respects.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's the same thing, really, and that's what it's like. But, again, you have an uprooted, dispossessed, desperate urban poor. You can go in, and then Nike can go in, and put in a factory and pay these people pennies a day, and call it capitalism.
Yep.
And then they can move the factories out of, you know, the developed north, where they have to deal with unions and higher wages, and so it's all part of this globalist scheme, and it's purely evil. It's but it's all part of a business model. If you don't like the word conspiracy, I'll call it a business model, I guess. You brought up this whole idea with Barry Seal, and his operations go back into the late 50s, and he's I might not have this detail correct, but he also was connected to Air America.
Yeah, Barry's dream was to go to Mexico after this Mena stuff and basically set up a version of Southern Air Transport or Air America out of Mexico. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being a teenager, Barry was involved in these CIA flights that were arming both sides in the Cuban War. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he had a long-standing relationship with all these CIA airlines. And I don't know, have you read anything by Terry Reid? Compromised.
Yeah, Compromised, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Terry details how Barry's dream was to move the Mena stuff over to Mexico and just you know, recreate that Southern Air Transport, American Air, out of Mexico.
Because what they did, of course, what they did in Vietnam with Laos, okay, we're back. Well, because if you look at Vietnam, the secret war in Laos that Nixon was fighting, of course, it even predates that from the Nixon administration. It goes back to the LBJ administration. But characters like Richard Secord, General Singlob, and Oliver North and Richard Armitage all go back to the Vietnam era when they were involved in the heroin trade and supporting that war during the Vietnam War. When that war closes down in the early 70s, I think Richard Secord moves on and starts dealing with Iran and Pakistan. And then you have the war, you know, in Central America. That's when Oliver North gets involved with the National Security Council in the White House. in cocaine dealing to fund that illegal war. So you have this. Now today we also have Afghanistan, the explosion of the heroin crop in Afghanistan with the U.S. invasion in 2001. And so in all these areas of operation, you have intelligence and massive drug dealing. So there's a pattern that we can all see that along with intelligence comes the illegal drug trade.
It's a place where crime and government coexists. And every country that America has invaded, drug production has increased.
Mm-hmm.
So that says it all right there.
Yeah. Now, you also address in your various lectures and interviews, you have, the connection or the nexus between the war on drugs, the prison industrial complex, and also the role that drugs play in international finance and the global economy. You want to get into that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Corrections Corporation of America, they're boasting in the annual report to their shareholders that our profit growth is guaranteed because they keep coming back. They're not correcting people, they're breaking them. So if you've got private prisons and all these other corporate entities making political contributions in the tens of millions each year to both parties, then of course whoever gets elected are going to keep these contracts going. And you got money going up, you know, to keep drug laws tight from private prisons, from alcohol, from tobacco, from pharmaceuticals. All these vested interests just putting this money up to keep this war on drugs going. For what? America has spent $2 trillion of taxpayers' money, and teenagers over there are saying it's easier for them to get heroin than it is alcohol because drug gangs don't have any qualms about selling heroin to school kids.
Mm-hmm. And with the, particularly with the Central American operation, when you said that the cocaine was being flown in real cheap, and that fueled the crack cocaine market in L.A., Los Angeles, which was featured or reported on by Gary Webb at the San Jose Mercury News in 1996, and exposed that connection. The deep business connections, too, because a lot of the proceeds would go into like record label companies that would promote the culture, that would promote the drug use. So there's a real sinister like business model at play here.
Well, look at Miami. Miami was built on cocaine money.
Yes. on the gambling industry, of course, we now have a president who has ties to the casinos, and that ties right back to Resorts International, which was the Mary Carter Paint Company, which was Meyer Lansky's front company.
Tyson Foods. You've not touched on Bill Clinton's role in all of this yet with Barry Seal.
We'll handle both of you. The Bush crime family involved in this. Now, how does the Clinton crime family factor into all this?
When the CIA were looking around for a state that would cooperate with them bringing billions of dollars worth of drugs in from South America, they settled on Arkansas because they thought the governor was one of the most corruptible. And that was Bill Clinton. So Bill Clinton provided state protection, state police, for the MENA operation. And in return for that, Clinton was paid massive amounts of money. Money was getting dropped from the sky, and it was getting laundered through a brokerage run by a guy called Dan Lassiter, who was one of Clinton's biggest financial contributors. And things got so out of control that Dan Lassiter got indicted on cocaine charges. And so did Bill Clinton's half-brother, Roger Clinton. He got indicted as well. But, of course, Bill turned around and pardoned them both after they'd served, you know, a small amount of time. You know, you see all these black guys getting life sentences for crack cocaine, yet if you're related to Clinton or you're a contributor, then you just get a slap on the wrist. Mm-hmm. And then Clinton, of course, went on to boost the prison population for the private prisons by 500,000, vast majority of them low-level drug users or low-level drug dealers.
Yeah, that was part of the reinventing government plan. Catherine Austin Fisk writes about that in The Aristocracy of Stock Profits. Dylan Reed in The Aristocracy of Stock Profits, that there was a business plan to swell the prison population at the same time set up this private prison corporation system where they yep. make a lot of money, just not only just on the bodies being there, because they get the bill like $50,000 a year per body in a cell, but they could then sell the labor for, you know, which is monstrous. Well,
the Clintons have even more insidious strategies than that. Arkansas was one of the last states to stop prisoners from selling blood on the international blood market that had been infected with HIV and hepatitis C. And all these people all over the world got sick, and many of them died. And they knew it was tainted, but they continued to sell it. And that was when Clinton was governor. And I think the guy that was running the blood stuff, he was another contributor to Clinton as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the same thing. I think, was it Tyson's Food that was allowed to pollute the rivers in Arkansas? And it was Hillary Clinton was representing them when her husband was governor.
That's the Dixie Mafia, isn't it?
Right there? Well, that's an example of the Dixie Mafia, because that's what made Arkansas was a landing and distribution for the cocaine coming in. And also wasn't the Arkansas Army used to refit weapons that were shipped to Central America and elsewhere?
What happened was, Terry Reed, he was put in charge of setting up a business so they could get the serial numbers off these weapons, and hopefully they wouldn't, you know, be traced back to this black op that the CIA was running. But all that blew up when Barry Seal's favorite plane, the Fat Lady, got shot down over Nicaragua after Barry had died. And Hassan Fass, or whatever his name is.
Eugene Hassan Fass, yeah.
He was paraded on TV, and he was basically saying, I was doing this for the CIA after Bush and Reagan, everybody denied it.
And the cover-up of the Iran-Contra was because the public was led to believe it was about trading arms for hostages and illegal shipments of arms to the Contras. In actuality, the big scandal was the fact that the operation involved the importation of massive amounts of cocaine into the United States to pay for the operations down in Central America, and also to make a lot of people rich, because as Richard Secord said when he was testifying on Capitol Hill, that it was a business. They're in it to make money.
that was a smokescreen, the Iran-Contra arms stuff. They were so terrified of the public finding out about the drugs part of it that Oliver North had drawn up a plan for martial law across America if the public found out and they reacted.
That was Rex 84, I think, part of FEMA, because he did work with Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Yeah.
There's an interesting part of the hearings in 1987 where I think it was Congressman Jack Brooks of Texas talks about it. And he starts talking about this plan to suspend the United States Constitution. Ordinarily, it was a contingency plan, continuity of government in case of a nuclear war. But then they downgraded it to like upheaval or disruption or protest, which is, you know. And so he said he asked Colonel North about this, and that's when the committee chairman Daniel Inouye, who also has interesting connections to intelligence, these congressional hearings we have, these things are all choreographed and controlled by the intelligence agencies. So they're not worth anything. They're a sideshow. I mean, they're you know, they themselves are part of the cover up. He says this is the type of thing that we should like to get into an executive session, you know. So they didn't want to talk about it in public. Jack Brooks was shut down. You know, you kind of naively asked him about it, and then it was immediately. The same thing occurred during the 1970s during the Church Committee hearings, when I think it was Colby said the same thing, that whenever a congressman asked an uncomfortable question, the response was, I think that's something we want to get to in executive session, meaning behind closed doors, meaning the public has no right to know what's really going on. You know, that's...
Yep.
That's what
have you watched the Kerry hearings?
Never all the way through, but it was the same thing. The Kerry hearings were a limited hangout cover-up, you know, so...
And that's how these guys get rewarded, because Kerry and Clinton prove to be team players, so then they get promoted, you know, Clinton gets the presidency.
Yeah, and Kerry gets moves on. I guess he gets the run for the office because he ran against a fellow Bonesman, and so he understood he had to lose that one. Of course, the only reporter to ask that question about their Skull and Bones membership happens to die of a heart attack a few years later. Tim Russert. Eh, could be a coincidence. It happens, but it is interesting. You know, but even Carey, his family, he's, I think it's John Forbes Carey, and that's an old, you know, that's an old Boston Brahmin family whose fortune was based on the opium trade.
Yep.
You know, but he had his, I guess, his bona fides as an anti-war protester back in the early 70s, and that's why people thought him as, you know, but you know, it's just one of these things. It's like you said, it's this war on drugs. It's a business. I think I was watching one of your interviews. You were just talking about this, the sheer scope of the business, what it involves. I think anywhere from $500 billion to $1 trillion a year is raised internet for the global market.
Well, if you look at oil, if you look at arms, and you look at drugs, three biggest businesses in the world, and they're all totally interlinked.
Yeah.
For example, Bush had all, you know, George H.W. Bush had this Zapata oil company, which mysteriously didn't make any money but kept going because the drugs were coming. They were getting smuggled in on, you know, the oil routes, the offshore platforms and the pipelines and...
No customs.
No customs.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... Zapata oil is interesting because it's in a... It's a, if you really look at Zapata oil, it looks like... It, I mean, it's a blatant intelligence front.
Yeah.
You know. I think they also involved, like, insurance fraud where, like, they have oil rigs... claimed were destroyed and they never existed. And if you look at the insurance business itself is integrated into the intelligence world because the intelligence world is high finance. Insurance is high finance. One of the interesting details of the Clinton scandals, the 90s, the sex scandals, was that it took a lot of attention away from, you know, MENA, Arkansas, and the real stuff, the real scandals that Clinton deserved to be impeached for, not just Monica Lewinsky. But of course, you know, Ken Starr, the special prosecutor that went after Lewinsky, the Lewinsky report and the salacious sexual details that it went into, and that became all the, that got all the attention here during that was the sex scandal because of Clinton's perjury and suborning perjury and obstruction of justice. But this is interesting news: is Ken Starr had no interest in MENA, Arkansas, in the finances.
Of course. Of course.
But if you look at Ken Starr, he is. He is the great nephew of Cornelis van der Starr, who started CV Starr Insurance, which became AIG. And he had connections going all the way back to Asia and the OSS and the opium trade.
Wow.
That's how deep it goes. And another thing about Kenneth Starr is, you remember the infamous Memorandum of Understanding between William French Smith and the CIA?
No, I'm not familiar.
Okay, well, there was a Memorandum of Understanding in 1982. And this was preparing for the run-up for the Central America Dirty Wars in Nicaragua, because they knew they were going to have to use drugs to pay for this stuff. But there's an understanding between the U.S. Attorney General's office, that he then was William French Smith, and they wrote a memo between the CIA that relieved case officers of having to report drug trafficking.
Right.
Okay, so that gave them the green light to get involved in drug running. And so in case, because they knew they'd have to intensify it, and they wanted to give the guys cover. But one detail I came across last year, looking into that, was William French Smith's deputy assistant was Kenneth Starr, who wrote that memorandum. You know, it's all control. Like...
If you go back to Kevin Ives and Don Henry, the medical guy who said that they'd fallen asleep on the tracks after getting stoned by marijuana, he'd actually helped Bill Clinton's mother out. I think she was a nurse, and she'd been responsible for some kind of medical death, and she was in some lawsuit, and he'd actually helped her out. So when Linda Ives kept trying to get justice, or at least the truth about what happened, you know, Clinton and the rest of the establishment, they wouldn't allow anything to go against that doctor. And if you look at Clinton as well, you know, his own history with cocaine, there's a video on YouTube of a doctor saying he was treated for nasal damage. And if I researched that more from snorting cocaine, and apparently Hillary showed up at the hospital and basically had the nurses against the wall saying, you know, they would never work again if anyone said anything about this, about her husband using the cocaine. 1958, Miss Arkansas, Sally Perdue, she had an affair with Clinton, said she saw him using coke regularly. He had all of the cocaine snorting equipment laid out like a real pro. Grand jury witness Charlene Wilson, she said that Bill and Roger had come up to them, and she watched Bill do cocaine, and he just kind of like slid. He was so wasted, he just slid down this brick wall. She specifically said he must have had an adenoid problem because he casually stuck the tooter up his nose, and he was so messed up that he ended up sliding down by a garbage can and sitting there like an idiot.
Yeah, if you're an oligarch, you're among the powers that be, that's definitely the type of man you want to be president. Because they're very compromised and very controllable.
Yeah.
Very, very weak. And that's those seem to be the people that are promoted, because you don't want anyone who's independent or, you know, any way independent, because how do you work with a guy like that? You want someone who's not going to get in the way of your agenda. And that's, I don't think we've had a president like that. Well, perhaps since JFK and what happened to him. You know, he seemed to buck the system a little bit. He was very much a scion of the system, but he seemed to, when he became president, to open his eyes a little bit, and then got his head blown off down in Dallas, Texas.
It wasn't his brightest idea to announce he was going to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces.
Yeah, I don't think he knew exactly. I mean, he and his brother were probably, although they could play dirty politics, they were men of power. They just certainly weren't perfect. But they had a naive streak in them, perhaps, because their father had engineered their political careers. And they thought they had, perhaps they thought they believed too much in the system and thought they had more power than they really had. And they realized they really didn't have any power at the end of the day.
Didn't the father have a stroke as well, and he was unable to counsel them, and they started branching out on their own?
Yeah, that's an interesting detail, is Joe Kennedy having that stroke, and it seems to be when RFK goes after the mob and rescinds on that deal that his father had made, you know, with the Chicago mob that got Jack the election. And it seemed to be like, you know, we had a deal, and so when it was almost like his father knew not to take it personally when his son was gunned down because he had broken that deal. And that's politics, you know. But the broader picture here is drugs, because you talked about some of your personal reflections when you saw the true cost of not just the drug war. The drug war is an important function because that creates the profitability of drugs. That's why they want drugs to be illegal. But the cost that drugs are part of what Catherine Authen Fitch calls a tapeworm economy. It deteriorates, destroys society. It doesn't help. It doesn't improve society, it actually destroys it. She has she calls it the red button story. Have you heard that?
I think I have read some of her stuff. It keeps society divided, and it's allowed the militarization of the police.
But drugs themselves, people don't realize just how incorporated drugs, the money that comes from drugs, how incorporated into the economy, in the stock market, and everyone's 401k plan. It finances the national debt. But at the same time, it's destroying societies, destroying communities. And this is why she has this popsicle index. And she says as the Dow Jones Industrial Average has gone up, the quality of life has gone down. And why she calls it the popsicle index is because it's the confidence you have that your six-year-old child can go down the corner market and buy a popsicle and come back and not be harmed.
Yeah.
In her day, people could do that. Now, today, you can't, even in the nice neighborhoods. And she attributes that lot to drugs. But she gives a story wherein, well, I have it verbatim. She says, in the summer of 2000, I was asked as a group of 100 people at a conference of spiritually committed people who would push a red button. Who would push a red button if it would immediately stop all the narcotics trafficking in their neighborhood, city, state, and country? Out of 100 people, 99 people said they would not push such a button. When surveyed, they said they did not want their mutual funds to go down if the U.S. financial system suddenly stopped attracting an estimated $500 billion to $1 trillion a year in global money laundering. They did not want their government checks jeopardized or their taxes raised because of the resulting problems financing the federal government's deficit. It's drugs that allow that financing and maintain their their pensions and their stock portfolios. So they themselves are investing the very thing that's destroying their communities.
Yeah, I mean, what's the public going to do if they can't go to the grocery store and have 10 different varieties of Fruit Loops? America consumes 25% of the world's resources. I think it would be more equitable if some of that was spread out.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a lot of Americans don't realize how the system works. They're not, you know, they believe in the fairy tale of their country being the greatest country on earth, home of the free, and home of the free and the brave. And when they're exposed to the dirty underbelly of the American system, they're not willing to look at it. They just want to go back and enjoy the bliss of their ignorance, and they're not willing to accept it.
Yep. Was it Crossing the Rubicon that really detailed all the money going in, how the corporations take advantage of the drug money?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was Michael Rupert, and he.
Yeah, that's it, Rupert. Yeah. Yep.
And both he and Catherine Austin Fitz have talked about the story of Richard Grasso, the president of the New York Stock Exchange.
Yep.
Going down to Columbia, meeting with the FARC guerrillas, and trying to get them to invest their money on Wall Street instead of spending it locally, developing locally. You know, and when the guy rejected his plan, that's when Plan Columbia started, and they started going after the FARC guerrillas. And this is what you mentioned, this one drug cartel going after the FARC guerrillas, well, because the FARC guerrillas did not cooperate.
Yeah, that was the Castaño brothers.
Castaño brothers, yeah.
And the interesting thing is that both sides are all, at the end of the day, end up fully armed with American weapons.
Yeah, which is almost, isn't that part of you get the impression that's what it's all about. I think there's at a meta level, there's some plan, I don't know, by the elite to degrade society through drugs. Certainly the British had that idea towards China. And if you read Aldous Huxley, and they're using drugs to opiate the people, to dumb them down and keep them from challenging the power of the oligarchy, that plan is there. But I think it was in Terry Reid's book, Compromised, when he's having a discussion, I think it was Michael Harari, the Mossad, spy, agent, drug dealer, arms trader, and he's talking about why are they doing what they're doing? Why are they stirring up these civil wars? Well, because the civil wars create the markets for the guns. And the guns are the ones that facilitate shipment of drugs in the United States, and that raises the cash, and that gets into the banking system, and it keeps the whole system going. But the system, at the end of the day, is destructive and parasitical. You're not adding wealth. You're actually destroying it. But I think what happens is you may be destroying wealth, but at the same time, you're concentrating it for a particular few, people like the Bushes.
And that's why they're fighting against legalization, because if you legalize drugs, that black market profit disappears overnight. So it's in the interest of the CIA to keep the black market going.
And we're told about the horrors of drug use, or at least the horrors of decriminalization and legalization. Yet I think you've cited in a few articles countries that have actually decriminalized or legalized drugs have had a marked reduction in drug addiction and crime, correct?
Holland are closing prisons down because they've got spare capacity. Portugal, they had over 100,000 heroin addicts. They were like, what should we do? We've got to try a new approach. Well, all right, well, if we decriminalize heroin, perhaps the addicts won't be afraid to get help. And the police said no. If you decriminalize heroin, what example does that set to young people? People will be doing heroin all over the streets. And what happened was the heroin addicts were no longer afraid to come forward to the health teams, and they got the addicts down from over 100,000 to less than 50,000.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about your own experience, how, well, the emptiness of it all, the materialism of it all, and the rampant consumerism that the drugs encourage. The emptiness of it all, that if you do switch your priorities and start devoting your life to actually helping people and improving your community, doing productive work and having actually caring about your fellow man and your community, how all of a sudden that lifestyle no longer is attractive anymore.
Yeah, I think a lot of people take drugs because they're hurting inside, and it's a form of self-medication. I'm not making excuses for what I did, but you know, when I was a teenager, I was almost beaten to death by some drunks. And my therapist said then, for over 10 years, I was self-medicating. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand that I'd been going through that. So if you can learn the root causes of what's causing people to get involved in drugs, if they can go inside themselves and address that, and the bottom line then is to put meaning into your life. And everyone has a different definition of that, but helping people, you know, I go out and speak to young people, and that helps me, I hope, restore my karma for the harm I cause society.
Mm-hmm. And that's another thing, is another example. This isn't the illegal drug market, but the legal drug market is very damaging. Big pharma, pharmaceuticals, how, particularly here in the United States, how so many people are medicated. They want to medicate their problems away. If they're feeling depressed, they take something to end a depression, as opposed to maybe addressing what's going on in their life. Maybe you should be feeling depressed or sad about something. Sometimes it is appropriate to feel sad about something or upset about something. These emotions have a function, and when you take drugs to suppress those emotions, you destroy the ability to empathize and to be a human being. You know, you lose your creativity, and you lose your humanity in these drugs.
I think in the West, these doctors are just indoctrinated to peddle pills to people. If you've looked at the DSM, that book just gets bigger every single year. You know, you've got things like intermittent explosive disorder, symptoms of which are getting angry. So, you know, there's a pill for that.
I like oppositional defiance disorder. I like that one.
It won't be long now before they have a pill for internet addiction or a vaccine for internet addiction.
Yeah, as the DSM gets thicker, the excuse for prescriptions increase. And that's profits for the pharmaceutical industry. I was reading an article by John Rappaport, and he was discussing how 1/4 of college students are now are receiving psychiatric care and are on drugs.
That's terrible.
Because they're having living life issues. They're coping problems, and it, you know. And if you look at what life is like on a college campus, if you take an 18-year-old. He leaves home for the first time, he or she leaves home for the first time, in their unfamiliar environment. Perhaps they didn't receive a good education, aren't prepared for college. They're not making friends. Perhaps they feel guilty about what they're doing, about hooking up, doing too many drugs or something. These are things that can, if someone takes the time to talk to them about it, maybe they'd be able to, you know, improve the situation by changing their behavior or dealing with what's really going on in their life instead of just giving them a pill to take, you know?
Yeah, and another thing that I've omitted to say is, if you look at young people, how they're groomed to commit crime, you know, this school to prison pipeline, and then if you look at the actual shareholders of the companies, the music companies that are putting out these, like the rap videos, telling young people to do cocaine, deal drugs, shoot the police,
mm-hmm.
Some of the biggest shareholders in these companies are some of the biggest shareholders in the private prisons.
That is something that is, because you can't imagine something so evil, but I can see a corporation coming up with a plan like that.
Yeah.
The idea that that they would think so far in advance and think about the long-term, the downstream profits from promoting the drug culture. That addressed this... there's an article I read, Government Drug Dealing from Kill the Messenger Pinocchio by Nathan Kleffman. He was referring to the movie about Gary Webb that came out a few years ago.
Yeah.
Here's a quote from the article. It goes, just addresses the very thing you're talking about. It says, just like when I woke up and saw how 100 different puzzle pieces only formed a coherent picture when taken together, watching Kill the Messenger in isolation may result in one walking away with the feeling that the story of government drug dealing must be exaggerated. Sure, there may be a few bad apples, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. But first, take a look at the decades of government complicity, collaboration, encouragement of worldwide drug dealing, and the forest from the forest of Nicaragua to the mountains of Afghanistan. Think of the hundreds of billions of dollars of drug money laundered through the largest and most prestigious banks on the planet. Contemplate the additional billions spent by taxpayers to, quote, fight a hopeless war that does nothing to stop drugs, but if anything, just takes out the government's small-time competition in the drug dealing business. Finally, review a network of industries making hundreds of millions of dollars in building jails, housing inmates, and profiting off their slave labor. Taken together, this is something so diabolical it only belongs at the doorstep of a shattered group like the Illuminati. You know, and that goes into just the school-to-prison project you're talking about, because at the same time, they've also, in the age of terror, where you have these school shootings, they by themselves are very suspicious, but that's justified these drills. Well, they were unannounced to have SWAT teams would go into schools and have a drill, have a fake school shooting, and terrorize the kids. And that's setting them up, creating a condition of fear. A while back, I was talking to a woman whose kid had just come back from school. You know, they live in a fairly well-to-do middle-class neighborhood, nice public school, and they had one of these drills, and the kid was traumatized by it.
Oh dear.
And it makes no sense, because again, the idea of the chances of you being in a school shooting are so infinitesimally small, it makes no sense to terrorize the kids. But it's conditioning them for fear, and also conditioning them to being treated, lined up by cops and being treated. It seemed like with these random drug searches they had in schools, right? With the dogs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's that school to prison project. Yeah. So.
Yep.
Now, I said I'd have you about an hour, so I don't want to take any more of your valuable time. Is there anything else you want to say, anything we didn't cover that you would want to mention?
I think we've pretty much covered everything. We've covered all the big points that I wanted to make. So, yeah, I think that was really good.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show. It was great. Now, your books, where should people go to follow your work?
Well, my books are available worldwide on Amazon. I've got about 7 or 8 books right now. So if anyone goes on Amazon, just puts in my name, Sean Attwood, SHAUNATT Wood, they'll all come up. And also on my social media, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, everything's just all under my name.
Great. Okay, that's SeanAttwood.com is your website, right?
And SeanAttwood.com is my website, yeah.
And it's Sean, SHAUN.
SHAUN, the English spelling, not the Irish English spelling.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Listen, look, Sean, thanks a lot. It's great. Great talking to you. Fascinating stuff. Your stuff is, I'm reading your book. It's great stuff. I'm going to get the Pablo Escobar book next and go through that. And I'll let you go. Let you enjoy the rest of your evening.
All right, Tim. Appreciate it. You have a good weekend over there in the States.
Take care then. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Cheers from London.
just don't care. No. So help me to see the light. I'm open my eyes again.